This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The 4th of July holiday, I think it's important to understand why they declared independence from Britain. They were concerned that the British might end slavery. They wanted the entire continent. They did not want Britain to stand in their way.
Margaret Kimberly, author of Presidential, talks about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson 246 years later after they signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, it is a day that reveals to him more than any other day of the year the gross conduct and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham.
Frederick Douglass delivered a speech on July 5th, 1852, to a group of abolitionists to remind them that the Declaration of Independence represented the unfulfilled promise of liberty for Africans who were captured and brought to the U.S. to work and build the infrastructure of this country for free while in chattel slavery.
It's very hypocritical how on the streets, a lot of us, because of our immigration status, we cannot attain a legal job, but yet in here, we're able to be hired for $1 a day.
Detained persons are being paid $1 a day for their labor at GEO Group detainment facilities.
And we're gonna fight. I'm gonna spend every waking hour fighting for Julian until he's free, until justice is served.
And an update on imprisoned WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Quote, Americans like to think of themselves as an exceptional people bound together by noble deeds. This belief is challenged, however, when history is taught more honestly and fully without omitting facts or telling outright lies. Presidents are outside characters in Americans' narratives about itself. Children attend schools named after them. There are monuments dedicated to them in every state. They have their own national holiday, President's Day, which presents an opportunity for the country's virtues to be celebrated. We are conditioned to feel a deep connection to these men hundreds of years after some of them have died. That's a paragraph from Presidential. Black Agenda Report editor Margaret Kimberly's book about the racial prejudice manifested by every single U.S. president in history. And Garrison spoke to Margaret Kimberly about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson 246 years after they signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776.
Let's begin with the first paragraph of your first chapter, which is about our first president, George Washington. Tell us about George Washington's false teeth.
There's a lot of mythology surrounding Washington that we're indoctrinated with from the time we're in grade school. The cherry tree and cannot tell a lie and so on. And one of the favorites is that he had false teeth, but they were made of wood. Well, they were not made of wood. He had dentures that at that time were made of ivory and metal. But there was also at the time tooth transplantation, and some of the dentures were actual teeth that were taken from the enslaved people that he held. And I open with this because I think it's important for people to understand the brutality of slavery. I mean, tooth extraction is painful now with anesthesia, with modern medicine. And that was just torture. There's no other way to describe what it had to have been at that time. But I think it was important for readers to understand Washington the man and the system of slavery, which he was very much a part of.
Now tell us why Washington, quoting your book, quote, rotated his human property for 6-month intervals between Pennsylvania and Virginia?
Well, the U.S. Capitol, before the Washington, D.C. was built, kept moving further south. It was first in New York City, where Washington was inaugurated, then moved to Philadelphia while this new city was being built. And Pennsylvania had a law which said that any enslaved person who was in Pennsylvania for more than 6 months could petition for their freedom. And this created a problem for George Washington, because that meant the people he held could potentially be freed. So he never allowed any of them to be in Philadelphia for that six-month period, which was a violation of the spirit and the letter of that law, because they realized that this loophole would allow people to do what Washington had done. And so this rotating people in and out was forbidden in this statute. And Washington consciously, deliberately broke that law.
So the father of our country broke the law to hold on to his enslaved people.
Yes, he did. He and his wife, Martha, owned more than 200 human beings. Most of those were what were called, people who were called dower slaves. That is to say, they belonged to the estate of Martha Washington's first husband, whose last name was Custis. And the fact that he and his wife owned so many people is very, very significant. It explains a lot about this country.
Can you tell us the story of Oney Judge, one of Washington's enslaved people?
Yes, Oney, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Oney, O-N-E-Y, Judge, was a young woman who managed to escape from the Washingtons when they were in Philadelphia. She escaped with the help of some people in the small freed population there. She managed to make her way to New Hampshire, and the Washingtons never gave up trying to get her back. They found out she was there. They tried to lure her back. Washington wrote a letter to someone seeking their assistance and calling her ungrateful. The ingratitude of the girl who was brought up and treated more like a child than a servant, he said, tells you a lot that they, despite having more than 200 people, that the one young woman escaping was a threat to the entire enterprise. And they were also lying to her because they could not free her, as she was one of these people referred to as dower slaves. So they lied to try to get her back. She was smart enough to know that she shouldn't, and she managed to remain free the rest of her life.
Okay, let's move on to Thomas Jefferson, the American president most often quoted for his erudite writing and scholarship. Tell us about Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase.
Well, the Louisiana Purchase, which is now roughly half of the United States, it was obviously Louisiana, Arkansas, states in the upper Midwest, the Dakotas, New Mexico, what's now Texas, and so on. And these territories came into the U.S. after the Haitian Revolution and the loss of Haiti, this very profitable French territory, meant that they needed money. And so they chose to sell their territories on the North American continent to the United States. And they came into America's possession. And Jefferson was president at the time. He had a lot of power over what happened in these territories, but he also was a slaveholder. But he would claim he thought slavery was evil and that it was wrong, although he never freed not one person, not even one. And he could have, had he been telling the truth about wanting to end slavery, this was his opportunity. There could have been, there were suggestions about gradual emancipation and so forth. But he was obviously not interested in that. These new territories allowed the U.S. to expand slavery. And it just goes to show you how much of a hypocrite he was. And this was the continuation of the settler colonial project, the ethnic cleansing against the indigenous population, stealing their lands, and spreading slavery as far and wide as they possibly could.
Did you, in your research, ever come across Jefferson's relationship with Lafayette, the French aristocrat who led a battalion of Haitian escaped people in the American Revolutionary War, then devoted the rest of his life to abolition?
I did not focus on Lafayette. I did, however, write about Kosciuszko, the Polish army officer who fought on the side of the U.S. in the Revolution, who had been a slaveholder, gave up the practice, urged Jefferson to do so. Jefferson always claimed he couldn't afford it. So Kosciuszko left him money in his will, and his argument being, okay, if you say you can't afford it, I'll leave you money and it'll compensate you. But to make a long story short, that did not happen, despite the fact that Kosciuszko died first. As far as black people fighting in the revolution, most of them fought for the British, because the British promised freedom to any enslaved person who fought for them. And there were many black troops on the side of the British. Many of them made their way to Canada after the war, to Nova Scotia in particular, and there are black communities in Nova Scotia to this very day because of that.
Is there anything you'd like to say about Sally Hemings?
Sally Hemings was one of the people that Jefferson held in slavery. She was his wife's half-sister. Her father was a white man, and so was her grandfather. She and Jefferson had five children together. The first, when I believe she was only 15 years of age, he never freed her. He never freed any of those children he had with her. And I think it's important for people to know that, too. That's not just salacious gossip. It says a lot about him as a person, about slavery, about the way that black women were victimized by men like Jefferson. And I think it's important to keep in mind, and I'm glad it's something that has come into wider knowledge over the years, that it's gone from being gossip to being actually proven to be true with DNA and other evidence.
He didn't free his own children?
No, he did not. And that was not uncommon. Well, actually, there were some exceptions. There were men who would free their own kids and provide for them in some way. But there were a lot of Jeffersons, like Thomas Jefferson. And it's ironic that is considered a quote-unquote black name. I think most people with the last name Jefferson are black, which is one of those ironies and slight mysteries of history. But no, he did not. And that shows you the extent of his hypocrisy. It shows you the extent of his own personal immorality and the true nature of the people called founding fathers, who we are taught, even at this late date in history, to admire and respect. They were genocidaires against the indigenous population and against black people as well.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say about these presidents whom Glenn Ford called those S.O.
Well, the 4th of July holiday, I think it's important to understand why they declared independence from Britain. They were concerned that the British might end slavery. They were also concerned that the British were impeding their efforts to settle further west and off of the eastern seaboard, but Britain had a problem with France. There was the Seven Years' War, which was called here the French and Indian War, the British against the French and their indigenous allies. Just to be clear, Britain and France were both trying to steal Indian land. But in any case, after that war ended, Britain wanted to make peace and forbade settlements further west of the Appalachians, which inconvenienced people like George Washington, who had already purchased land past the Appalachians. So that was in 1763, and it was one of the biggest reasons that there's a 4th of July at all. They wanted the entire continent. They did not want Britain to stand in their way. They had other arrangements with France, which allowed them to claim territories in what's now the U.S. Midwest. And in order to complete and really fulfill the settler colonial project, they had to have an independent nation that was free from the British crown. And I think it's important to have that information and understand why there was a movement for independence at all.
Okay, Margaret Kimberly, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Thank you so much.
That was Margaret Kimberly, executive editor of Black Agenda Report and author of Prejudicial, speaking with Ann Garrison.
We want to talk about it. Colonized mind. Upload the revolution principle. You see a rock on the shore and say it's always been there. Download, no responsibility. Do what you want, nobody cares. Upload the master race idea. Genetically disposed to rule the world. Download a future full of isolated, full of isolated boys and girls. Upload a two-party system. The lesser of two dangers, illusion of choice. Download a veiled form of fascism. Nothing really ever changed. You never had a voice. Joint venture record deal. It's just another way for the man to steal while he's sticking you with the bill. Download a temporary acquisition, a fleeting flame and fortune. Nothing to leave in your will. Hey, 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 hey.
That was Prince, Colonized Mind. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Frederick Douglass delivered a speech on July 5, 1852, to a group of abolitionists, reminding them that Africans who were captured and enslaved, that the Declaration of Independence represented the unfulfilled promise of liberty for all. Here's Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from the speech at a program organized by the U.S. National Archives and Records.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, it is a day that reveals to him more than any other day of the year the gross conduct and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. You know what is a swine drover? I'll show you a man drover. They inhabit all of our southern states. They perambulate the country and crowd the highways of the nation in droves of human stock, armed with pistol, whip, and bowie knife, driving 100 men, women, and children. These wretched souls are to be sold singly or in lots to suit purchasers. They are food for the cotton field and the deadly sugar mill. March the sad procession as they move along, and the savage wretch who drives them. See the old man with locks thin and gray. See the young woman whose shoulders are bare to the scorching sun. Her briny tears falls on the brow of the babe in her arms. See too the young girl of 13, weeping as she thinks of her mother from whom she's been torn. Mark the sad procession. Heat and sorrow nearly consumes their strength. Suddenly you hear a quick snap, like the discharge of a rifle. The fetters clank, the chains rattle. Your ears are saluted with a scream that seems to have torn its way into the center of your soul. The crack you heard was the sound of a whip. The scream you heard was the mother with the babe in her arms. Her strength had faltered under the weight of the chains and the child, and the gash in her shoulder tells her to move on. Follow the procession to New Orleans. Attend an auction there. See men examined like horses. See the frames of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. Tell me, citizens, where under the sun can you witness such a spectacle more fiendish and shocking? Yet this is but a glimpse of the American slave system as it exists in the ruling part of the United States. But it is just in this moment when I hear someone in my audience say, it is just at this time that you and your fellow abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression upon the public mind. If you would argue more and denounce less, if you would persuade more and rebuke less, your cause might be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there's nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? Am I to argue the point that the slave is a man? The point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. Slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of the laws of their government. They acknowledge it when they punish a slave for disobedience. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia, which, if committed by a black man, may subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of those same crimes, if committed by a white man, may subject him to like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? Southern statute books are filled with enactments teaching the slave under severe fines and penalties how to read and to write. When you can point to any such laws as it relates to the beast of the field, then I will consent to argue the manhood of the slave. Americans! Your Republican politics, as well as your Republican religion, is fragrantly inconsistent. You boast of your love for liberty, your high civilization, your pure Christianity, while all the while the whole political power of the nation conspires to hold in bondage 3 million of its countrymen. You celebrate fugitives from abroad. You honor them with banquets. You toast them. You salute them. You bless them. But of your own fugitives at home, you advertise. You hunt, arrest, shoot, and kill. You mourn fallen hungry. You make her wrongs the subject of your poets, your orators, and your statesmen. But of the 10,000 wrongs committed against the American slave, you enforce the strictest silence and would deem him an enemy of the nation that would make their subject public discourse. You say that all men are created of one blood and that all men everywhere should love one another, yet you notoriously hate those whose skin is not colored like your own. You proclaim before the world, and before the world proclaim, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have been endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet, you hold in bondage a seventh part of the inhabitants of your country. Friends, the existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism a sham, your humanity a base pretense, your Christianity a lie. It destroys your moral power abroad. It corrupts your politicians at home. It saps the very foundation of religion. It makes your name a hissing and a byword to a mocking earth.
That was Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from Frederick Douglass' speech delivered July 5, 1852, to a group of abolitionists in Rochester, New York. Douglass used the occasion not to celebrate the nation's triumphs, but to remind all of its continuing enslavement of millions of African people. Visit the U.S. National Archives and Records to learn more.
So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, legendary Amiri Baraka.
This is an excerpt from a poem called Why Is We Americans? But reality is an excerpt on television. Why is we Americans? Why is we Americans? Boo-dee-da, 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 boo-dee-da. Be de 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 boo de boo de boo boo boo. What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm gonna be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and featherings, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Street you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you copped, the careers you stopped. All these are suits. Specific litigation as represent we, be like we, for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da. We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black belt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time is funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wills. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that, all that, all that, all that. Be-dee-da, doo-doo. Bap, 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 doo, doo, doo. All that you got to give up. Autonomy and reparation to the Chicanos and the Native Americans whose soul you ripped out with their land. Give self-determination, regional autonomy. That's what my we is asking, and they gonna do the same when they demand it like us again in their own exploited name. Yeah, the education, that's right. 200 years. We want a central stash, a central bank with democratically elected trustees and a board elected by us all to map out from the referendum we set up what we want to spend it on to build that Malcolm sense self-determination as self-reliance and self-respect and self-defense, the will of what the good Dr. Du Bois beat on, true self-consciousness, simply the psychology of freedom. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, be-dee-da, boo-dee-da, that ba 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 boo-dee-boo-dee-boo-boo-boo. Then we can talk. about being American. Then we can listen without the undercurrent of desire to first set your ass on fire. We will only talk of voluntary unity, of autonomy, as vective arms of self-determination if there is democracy in you. That is where it will be shown. This is the only way we as Americans, this is the only truth that can be told. Otherwise, there is no future between us but war, and we as rather lovers and singers and dancers and poets and drummers and actors and runners and elegant heartbeats of the sun's flame. But we as also at the end of our silence and sit down. We as at the end of being under your ignorant smell, your intentional hell. Either give us our lives or plan to forfeit your own.
That was Amiri Baraka, Why Is We Americans, from Deaf Poetry Jam. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Prison labor is a growing profitable industry in the U.S., and while slavery has supposedly been outlawed, detainees at the GEO Group facilities in California are being paid only $1 a day. Detainees who have to pay $4 an hour to make a phone call also face serious health and safety conditions along with COVID outbreaks. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with strike leaders Garcia and Serafin, who are being paid $1 a day for their labor at GEO Group Detainment Facilities Golden State Annex and Mesa Verde Facilities for company profits. He also spoke with Esperanza Qualte Velasquez with Pangea Legal Services and Edwin Carmen Cruz with the Collaborative for Immigrant Justice.
Esperanza, why don't you introduce what has been going on?
So today I'm here accompanied by my colleague Edwin Carmona, as well as Garcia and Serafin. Well, Garcia, he's currently detained at the GEO facility Golden State Annex in McFarland, and Serafin is detained at the Mesa Verde Detention Center, just about 20 miles away from McFarland, which is now located in Bakersfield. And something that I want to share with all of you is that this is the second yet longest labor strike in a period of 8 months. The first strike occurred in late October of 2021 when GEO tried to cut down the number of porters from 10 total to 2 porters per shift to clean and maintain the dorm, or a dorm with a bed capacity of up to 88 people. This strike lasted about 17 days, and currently leaders who are detained at Mesa Verde are on their 62nd day of strike, and it has spread to Golden State Annex.
I am a brother, I am a son, I am an uncle. The reason why I'm here is because of the collaboration between CDCR and ICE. Being transferred into this detention center upon my release date, and, you know, for me, experiencing what I have been experiencing is very inhumane. That we suffer here, we're not treated as people, subhuman, and treated as thus. Very sad, and it's very alarming that people on the outside in the world do not get to see. All people get to see or hear is what they're being told, and that we're being treated fairly and right. While these facilities continue to operate is on the labor and exploitation of us in here. Our work, how we maintain the facility on a daily basis, is what keeps profits going to the pockets. And for us, being paid $1 a day is, at the end of the week, is $5. Imagine when we go eat in the dining hall, the food that they give us is all processed, it smells and tastes old, and the servings are very small. Having to go to commissary to buy a bag of rice or a bag of beans, which is ounces each, to make a video phone call to our families or their loved ones, is a 15-minute video call is $3.15. Can you imagine living on $5 a week? Buy these necessities for yourself to buy hygiene and food. You can't survive on that. It's very hypocritical how on the streets, a lot of us, because of our immigration status, we cannot attain a legal job. But yet in here, we're able to be hired for $1 a day. That's pretty outrageous. And, you know, the conditions that we have to face while we're in here. Just to paint a picture of how oppressive it is for someone to really understand that we're in a dorm that I'm pretty sure may not meet the standards of safety because it's very small and it holds 100 people in here. Windows are sandblasted, and we could only tell if it's light or day outside. Other than that, we're not offering any programs or activities in order for us to not stress, face anxiety. People who have mental issues like that, you know, it becomes very hard for them. And also, too, with our labor strike that we've been having in here in the dorm, you know, the sanitation in here has become very awful. You know, grime have been building up, and even mold, black mold have been building up. The grievance system that we use is very arbitrary. And when we would grievance the sanitation in here, officers, when they come and clean, they do a very poor job, and they complain about it because they say they're not janitors, and they do a very poor job. And instead of fixing the problem through our grievances, what the facility came and did was they just painted over the walls and over the mold. That's not fixing the problem. Mold can be very hazardous, and just to do that, that just shows the lack of disregard for our health and, you know, our well-being in here. That's just like a small, you know, picture of what it is that we have to face on a daily basis. And the retaliation in general. When we first started the labor strike in the dorm, we had officers come in here to approach individuals and tell them that, what is it that I hear that you're being a troublemaker? Just because I don't want to participate in their voluntary or supposedly voluntary work program, labeled as troublemakers. How is that fair? You know, those are just a few of the things that me personally, I wanted to highlight. And, you know, like I said, retaliation in general is something, and people are always afraid of it, because some of the things too that, you know, individuals are told all the time is that word about it is going to get to the immigration judge and it's going to affect our case. And some people believe it, which, you know, I know that's not true. And, you know, but these are some of the things that, you know, the officers, they intimidate us and try to bully us in order to coerce us into forced labor in their supposedly voluntary work program.
And GEO is a for-profit company, so they're making a lot of money off these detention facilities.
They made this quarter alone over $500 million for them just to treat us like we're less. Yeah, so they're paying us smaller, like a smile. As Alphine said, right? That just adds to the fact that we also have to buy hygiene.
The hygiene issue comes also at the same time that there's a COVID pandemic. Have you gotten proper testing and protection against COVID?
Oh, when we had an outbreak here back in, I believe it was in January, I was demanding for a COVID test, would not give it to me. It was stood up and like, hey, we need a COVID test. There's an outbreak. We were together at visiting during sports. We were exposed to this individual. It was, please give us a COVID test. COVID is killing people out there. And what we're less, because we're in detention, but alone, we have poor ventilations in here. They have, I've been here going on a year, never seen them clean the vent or out. So poor ventilation just adds to the mold problem that we have in the shop. These are not living conditions whatsoever. Their sentence, they want to hold us, that's double jeopardy. For what? We're not criminals. It's on top of that, we don't have any mental health professionals, let alone a doctor. We don't have a doctor on site. We don't have anybody to help us with our mental. We ask to see a mental specialist. I personally have asked to see a mental specialist, and I still haven't seen one.
Right here at Mesa Verde, we face the same things. And physically, mentally, and emotionally draining for individuals to be here, to be experiencing any form of detention, whether it's a day or 4 years, like I've seen individuals.
We've been on right here in Golden State on a labor strike for about 22 days today, right? The litter cleaning is, they're not cleaning, period. We have, in this dorm, we have insects that were coming out from the sinks that have now moved onto the floors in the restroom and the day room area. The lieutenants hire people, and the administration has seen this. We've been like, we're in a pandemic as well. How are you guys not, well, we're out of a pandemic, but still COVID times. Oh, are we not, are you guys not cleaning to standards that you must? These are living conditions. I guarantee, I told them specifically, guarantee if you had any type of pests in your house, you wouldn't wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. We've been waiting for a month for something to be done about this, and still to this day, nothing has happened. So that falls under the umbrella of our mental health as well, because it's like stating, like, we don't care what your guys' living conditions, we don't want it out of you, period.
If the facility did not have to depend on the work of Serafin and Garcia, they would hire someone else to do it, right? They would hire a cleaning service to come in and clean, or they would hire GEO workers or have GEO workers go in there and clean. Guess how much they're getting paid? They're not getting paid $1 a day to clean. Mm-hmm. They're getting paid $15, $20, $25 an hour for 8 hours, even more, right? Clean. So in this case, there's clearly a difference. They're providing the same service, working the same amount of hours, yet for whatever reason, right, the facility is saying we're only going to pay you a dollar because we absolutely have to.
We do deserve to get paid the state minimum wage, which is $15 an hour for the work that we do.
You are basically being used to make profit for these corporations.
We are literally being used exactly how you say it. We're used as profit. That's all they see is money sign. All they see, they want us here so they can continue to make all these millions of dollars. That's very humiliating and depressing, horrible. Like, I'm a human being. How are you supposed to make money off me? And I'm just going to make, you're going to give me a dollar to clean your job? Like, it makes no sense whatsoever to me.
The way I see it, too, is that, you know, we don't necessarily have to be here. You know, whether it's the administration or whether it's ICE in general, they don't necessarily have to detain us. And we could be released to our communities, to our families, right? A lot of us have been through prison, and we are rehabilitated, right? We don't have to be here in detention, spending a day, a year, 4 years. It doesn't matter. We don't necessarily have to be here. They have the power to release us into our communities and back with our families, right? However, they use taxpayers' money to continue to house us here and continue to make profits off of us.
That was Pacifica Steve Zeltzer interviewing prison labor strikers at the GEO Group facilities in California with Esperanza Qualte Velasquez with Pangea Legal Services and Edwin Carmen Cruz with the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice. The labor strike continues the week of July 4th. To support them, you can find out more at kwesi.org. That's kwesi.org. Classic from 1976, Doobie Brothers, Taking It to the Streets. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. In an update on the case of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange, the British government predictably announced that it will follow through on the threat to extradite Assange to the U.S. to face charges under the U.S. Draconian Espionage Act of 1917. This is an unprecedented use of this law to suppress truth-telling media for exposing many of the crimes against humanity committed by agents of the U.S. government in countries around the globe, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and here in the belly of U.S. imperialism. Thomas O'Rourke reports.
British Home Secretary Priti Patel signed Julian Assange's extradition order on Friday, June 17th, whereupon Belmarsh prison guards vindictively stripped Assange and threw him into an empty cell as a means to ostensibly prevent his suicide, said Assange's father, John Shipton. It is not the end of the road for Assange legally, however. His lawyers also announced that day that they have until July 1st to file for an appeal of Patel's decision to the High Court. This has occurred, though the written documents are not yet public. The lawyers also intend to apply for a cross-appeal of issues, not just the narrow issue permitted by the British court related to Assange's mental health and potential for suicide. This cross-appeal will include the political nature of the charges, the threat to free speech, and the reported CIA plot to kidnap and or kill Assange before his arrest. It will include the surveillance of Assange within the Ecuadorian embassy by the Spanish security firm UC Global in a counterintelligence operation on behalf of the CIA. According to Article 4 of the U.S.-UK extradition treaty, extradition shall not be granted if the offense for which extradition is requested is a political offense. If extradited to the U.S., Assange, the father of two young British children, faces a sentence of 175 years in prison merely for receiving and publishing truthful information that revealed U.S. war crimes. Speaking first will be Assange's spouse, Stella Morris, followed by one of his lawyers, Jennifer Robinson.
We're not at the end of the road here. We're going to fight this. We're going to use every appeal avenue. And we're going to fight. I'm going to spend every waking hour fighting for Julian until he's free, until justice is served.
My name is Jennifer Robinson. I'm a legal counsel for Julian Assange and for WikiLeaks and have been representing Julian for over a decade. This is the outcome that we have been concerned about for the last decade. This decision is a grave threat to freedom of speech, not just for Julian, but for every journalist and editor and media worker in this country. He faces 175 years in prison for publishing information for which he's won journalism awards the world over and has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. This should shock and concern everyone, every citizen, every journalist, every editor, every media organisation. We will continue to appeal. This is not the end of the road. And we will use every appeal mechanism available to us to prevent this extradition. We continue to call upon the Biden administration to drop this case because of the grave threat it poses to free speech everywhere and across the United States. And we continue to call on the Australian government to take action and to protect this Australian citizen who is at risk.
Saturday, July 2nd, was Assange's 51st birthday and was marked around the world by tens of thousands in the streets demanding his freedom. We'll leave you with audio from Melbourne, Australia, of a street rally demanding that the Australian government defend its citizen and subject from this concerted campaign of political prosecution and suppression of journalism and free press, which thus suppresses an informed citizenry that depends on said free press. For COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is Thomas O'Rourke.
Hi, everybody, we're being told to move on. We're going up Collins Street to the British consulate. And we have a new chant. It goes, US, UK, hands off Assange. 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 US, UK, hands off Assange.
From the 1969 Woodstock performance, this is a classic by the great Jimi Hendrix. And now, a few words from George Carlin, who reminds us in his 1992 performance in New York City that Americans like war.
Well, we like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. And you know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car, can't make a TV set or a VCR worth Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right. Especially if your country is full of brown people. Oh, we like that, don't we? That's our hobby. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country, tell them to watch the f*** out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bull. That's our f***ing job. That's our f***ing job. Now we only bomb brown people. Not because they're trying to cut in on our action, just because they're brown. Now, you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them, I don't really believe in my country, and I gotta tell you folks, I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded.
Here's the late, great Toni Morrison sharing her thoughts about democracy.
The consequences of becoming a democracy are out there. We emphasize that part, but we're also a major capitalist and capitalistically formed country. And it's true of all of Europe. I mean, you know, the slaves have come home from the plantation. The wars are still going on. The Cold War, they keep talking about these years of peace. Peace? What peace? They've been fighting 30 years of wars elsewhere. All the blood was shed in the Third World. Our confrontation with Russia, our confrontation with communism. There was no nuclear explosion. There were no, you know, there was enough, but they still fought. I'm not so sure that these problems are not, what could have been foreseen. They're inevitable. You can't call those countries poor when they have all the tungsten in the world and two high schools. You can't call Latin America poor third world when they have all of the resources. I mean, the whole language is wrong. So yeah, we're going to have problems. We don't want
them. And that concludes the 4th of July edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. thanks for listening.